Welcome, everyone, to episode 440 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have the final set. The Milwaukee Bucks closed out the Atlanta Hawks last night, so we have Bucks, Suns in the finals, every TV executive's dream. So we will preview the finals today, and we will bid goodbye to the Los Angeles Clippers and Atlanta Hawks and dive into their big offseason questions as well. Before we get to all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can also find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a man who, once again, I have to congratulate on some football. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It's going well. Yeah, we are heading to the semifinals against England, and England right now are super confident to the point where our nation is asking the question, are they a bit too confident? So Wednesday, it goes down. We'll see what happens. We're all super excited. There's a patriotism, especially in regard or particularly in sports right now, that's going on. Not your kind of patriotism, which right now, ironically, July 4th. So in order, Brian, how many guns have you bought? How many burgers have you eaten? And how many pounds of firework have you fired off so far?
Zero fireworks, because I don't want my dog to have a nervous breakdown. We do have 2 pounds of burgers defrosting tonight. And guns, I didn't have a daughter. I had a son, so I have not bought 15 shotguns for when my daughter turns 12. But God forbid if I do have a girl, I'm just driving straight back to Tennessee going, I know which gun show it is because it's advertised in a big billboard on the highway. Gonna load up. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, congratulations, America. It's
yeah.
You have all the reason to be proud, I think.
I will say I've been pleasantly surprised. My dog hates fireworks, nervous breakdown, trembling, shaking. But we put on the baby's white noise machine last night when we started to hear the fireworks, and he was completely unperturbed. So I think nice. Knock on wood, we'll try it again tonight. But I'm tentatively hopeful. And if that's the case, I would advise anyone who's got noise anxious dogs who hates the 4th of July, it's a very common problem, go buy a little cheap portable white noise machine, or if you have one, if you have a kid, turn that thing on. Because, man, it was this was the calmest he's ever been on a July 3rd.
Nice. Go Team North.
Yeah. All right, Mort. So let's dive right in. We got the finals set. We don't know the status of Giannis Antetokounmpo. I think that's the biggest question heading into this series. Chris Haynes...
Wait. Is it? Is that the biggest question heading into this series? I thought the biggest question heading into this series is, oh my God, is Chris Paul going to leave Phoenix for New York?
Yeah, I don't think he's focused on that right now. I hope he's not.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I very much can guarantee that he's not. And that's not even sourced. That's just me being logical. Right. This is a man who's been chasing the NBA Finals for, 15 years? I damn near guarantee you he's not thinking about free agency right now whatsoever.
Yeah, and you were referencing a report from Ian Begley that was poorly aggregated and made the rounds. Basically, all he said was, if Paul does leave the Suns, several agents for point guards in the 2021 free agent class fear New York as a possible landing spot for Paul, noting that Leon Rose, the team president, was Paul's agent. But then he follows with the sentence that provides context that was missing from the aggregation. But again, New York would only be an option for Paul if he and Phoenix didn't reach an agreement. And something tells me, fresh off of his first finals appearance, he's not going to leave Phoenix for the New York Knicks.
Right.
Going to go out.
And if they win the championship in particular, yeah.
Right.
Of course, it's not because it's my area to talk about these things. I'm not Chris Paul, but it stands to reasons that he would be sticking around. But again, that's none of my business.
Right. Okay, but so assuming the Chris Paul free agency does not hover over the finals, on court wise, Giannis Antetokounmpo status, he hyperextends the knee in game 4, misses games 5 and 6 of the Hawks series. The Bucks close it out without him. Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports reported there's belief that Giannis would have been given the green light for a potential game 7 if the Hawks avoided elimination in game 6. Game 7 would have been Monday. Game one of the finals is on Tuesday. So there's a chance that Giannis is ready to go for game one. And if that's the case, right now the Phoenix Suns, according to FanDuel Sportsbook, are a 5.5 point favorite in game one. So I don't want to tell you what to do with your money, but if there's a chance Giannis plays in this game, you might put a little bit of money on the Bucks just to see what happens. But let's assume that Giannis misses game one at least. I think based on that report, it sounds like he will be back at some point in the finals, knock on wood.
Right.
But if he does miss some time, what do you do if you're the Bucks? Do you keep that same starting five that you did in these last two games against the Hawks, where Bobby Portis came in and took his place? Or do you, there aren't a ton of other good options, but what would you do if you're in Milwaukee?
Well, see, I've given up on trying to replace P.J. Tucker in the lineup. And honestly, I don't really see what he can do in this series, like where he's become a necessity to play 32 minutes per game. Mm-hmm. Like if he's all defense, which at this point he is, okay, you can get him on Jay Crowder, I guess, but is that just, like, what's the point there? I would much rather sacrifice a heavy load of his minutes and get some firepower in there. And when I say firepower, I'm fully recognizing that the Bucks don't really have a whole lot. By firepower this time around, I'm meaning, like, Pat Connaughton.
Right.
Because that's what they have to replace him with. But no, I would stick with Bobby Portis. I would hope that Bryn Forbes comes into the finals ready to shoot. I think they need that offensive versatility. So I don't have any realistic expectations of P.J. Tucker getting out of the starting lineup, so I'm fully expecting him to be there. But I would personally start Pat Connaughton and Bobby Portis instead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's at least dangerous to assume that what worked against Atlanta will work against Phoenix, because they present two very different challenges, especially since Trae Young, missed game five and was very hobbled during game six. And just personnel-wise, they're different teams. Like, Phoenix has not one but two guards that you really need to worry about in Chris Paul and Devin Booker. And then you've got the two forwards in Bridges and Jay Crowder, and then Ayton as well. So how do you see, just in general, Milwaukee matching up defensively with Phoenix? Like, who do you put on, I'm assuming Drew guards one of Paul and Booker, and probably switches between the two. But do you put, do Holiday on Paul, Middleton on Booker, and then, Portis and Tucker, or Portis and Connaughton on the two forwards?
Yeah, absolutely I do. I mean, look, so Jay Crowder isn't a guy who slashes a whole lot. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have great foot speed, so I feel perfectly confident in putting Bobby Portis on Jay Crowder. I mean, what is Jay Crowder going to do?
Right. It mostly spot up in the corner.
Right, exactly. Which is, again, why I wouldn't waste 32 minutes on P.J. Tucker. I just don't see... If Jay Crowder was someone who could create off the triple, then I would see that argument. But he's just a spot-up guy, so put Bobby on him. Look, Drew Holiday, I think, might be the best bet out of anyone in these playoffs to slow down Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. And I realize some Clippers fans are going to say, well, Pat Bev, no, because Drew is just bigger. He is so much stronger. He can really get Paul out of his rhythm, I think, or at least he's the guy who stands the best chance to do so. That said, of course, it's Chris Paul. You're not going to force him into some kind of, laying an egg or anything of that sort. Paul is going to get his, but it's just going to be a little bit more difficult. What is Drew, 6'4", 200 pounds or something like that? And then he's just sturdy. Like, he is not going to give up ground whatsoever. So I would definitely want to see him spend the vast majority of the time on Chris Paul. And you're right, he's probably going to switch onto Devin Booker at times as well. I would also start Middleton on Booker, because he's got the size advantage. He's got, he doesn't have the speed advantage, but I think he can stick with Booker, because Booker isn't one of those overpoweringly athletes who has one of those great first steps and just this tremendous burst of explosion. So I think Middleton can stick with him for the most part. I think this Bucks team is defensively geared up towards being a pretty tough cover for Phoenix, and that's even without Giannis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one selling point for keeping Tucker in the starting lineup is that you wouldn't have, you could put him on Booker at times and save Middleton, let Middleton focus more offensively, and you can hide him on one of Mikhail.
Would you trust that, though?
I mean, no, but I don't trust any of these guys to, like, completely shut down Booker.
But, I mean, I get P.J. Tucker on Durant, for example. Right. And, like, I'm not saying Durant is slow. Durant is still quick, but Booker is smaller and thus just more compact in his movement, so he is, by definition, quicker. I think P.J. would get completely annihilated if he went at Booker, no? Like, just the ball handling, like, his ability to create space. Good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, running Booker around a ton of screens and making P.J. Tucker keep up with that or fight through that, if anything, you're probably going to get at least one or two cheap fouls just because, you know, he's going to have to run through a guy and they'll, whether it's a flop or they actually fall down, I don't know. But, you know, like, that's an easy way to pick up, you know, a couple fouls and get closer to the bonus or get him out of the game. Yeah. But, I mean, it speaks to kind of the difficulty the Bucks will have, at least until Giannis returns, is that they just don't have a super great answer for Devin Booker.
Right. By the way, when Giannis returns, I'm going to say when, because I want that to happen.
Yeah.
I want Giannis on CP3.
Ooh, and then Drew on Booker?
Yeah. And then Middleton can, like, move up and take Bridges. Again, Bobby Portis could still be in there, and then you get P.J. Tucker out of Dodge. And then, again, he's not going to be in a danger zone by guarding Jay Crowder. I would love that. Just Giannis on CP. Just completely bury him with length and athleticism. I think that could be so much fun to one. Obviously, it's also a tremendous task to ask of someone who just had a knee issue.
Right,
so
right.
I'm well aware that it might not happen, but I think just from a tactical perspective, it could be fascinating.
Yeah, and it might actually, I mean, you know, 6 foot nothing Chris Paul versus 6'11 Giannis, like having, you know, Paul has been burying teams with that mid-range jumper from the right elbow or from the baseline, but is he going to be able to get that off over Giannis's outstretched arms?
I don't think so. Yeah. Honestly, that might be the one guy he can. Like, I know, he got it off against Rudy, so people will make that argument, and that's true. Like, he got it off consistently against Rudy and I'm blanking on the other. Nikola Jokic as well. Like, he's gotten that shot over people consistently throughout the course of his career. But Giannis might just be quick enough, long enough, and just defensively inclined to understand, okay, I need to be one step closer to him. Mm-hmm. Whereas Rudy just was slow-footed, same with Jokic. Giannis, I don't think, like, he won't allow that shot. Like, he'll get it off here and there, but it's not going to be a consistent weapon that Paul could go to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there is something to that theory. The Atlanta series will be good preparation for having to deal with a problem like Paul in particular, who can kill you both as a scorer and a facilitator. Like, game one, we saw the Bucks' strategy against Trae Young was let him go for 40, let's stick to the other guys, cut off his passing lanes. So they could try that with Chris Paul as well. Let's, you know, let him go off, but we're going to really stick to Devin Booker in particular and Ayton, right, and make it really hard on them. You know, if they could actually execute that strategy is a different question. So, like, that's the thing. They have to basically choose with Chris Paul, which one do you want to stop, him as a scorer or him as a passer? Because you're probably not going to be able to do both. But you have to do at least one.
I think my overall goal, if I'm Milwaukee and I have Giannis back, is just to rotate Drew, Middleton, and Giannis onto those two guys, mm-hmm, like CP and Devin Booker. Because if you take those two guys out of the game into some capacity, I just don't trust the rest of the players around them to create enough off the dribble. Like, that's not to say that DeAndre Ayton won't have a tremendous game. That's not saying that DeAndre Ayton won't maybe actually win them something by pulling something out of his ass. Like, that could happen. But if you have that trio rotating in whichever way on those two guys, CP and Booker, I mean, that's probably your best bet defensively.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
So let's actually go to Ayton, because to some extent, this is a bad matchup for him since Lopez has the size to deal with him in the post. But the Bucks, as we know, have loved their drop coverage. And against CP and Booker, I don't know how that's going to work out. So
right.
what do you see the Bucks doing adjustment-wise to, you know, stick Lopez with Ayton, make sure he doesn't get loose in the post or on rim runs or anything like that, especially in pick and roll, but also, you know, make sure he's not dropping so close to the basket that Chris Paul and Devin Booker have their way in the mid-range?
Right. Honestly, I would just not leave Ayton, and then I would have help from the wings come up and challenge the ball handler instead. Yeah. And then I realize that's a driving kick. I realize that that opens the door to wide open corner threes. But we also know that Milwaukee, for years, have accepted that shot. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't shock me if they go that route whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, there's no great answer. That's the fun thing about going against superstars. Like, you're not going to take away everything. There is no great answer. And even if you force them into the least efficient shot in the game, especially for a guy like Chris Paul, that's not an inefficient shot. So right. Milwaukee certainly has its defensive challenges, especially until Giannis returns.
Yeah. But I will say, in half-court situations, if they drop the ball down to Ayton, mm-hmm. Brooks stands a pretty good chance there. Not saying that he's going to shut Ayton down. I think Ayton is more talented offensively than we give him credit. But Brook is a very, very large human being. Just to the sheer size alone, I think he's one of those people who really can push DeAndre off of his spots a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be so interesting to see how DA is going to adapt. Because if there's one thing we've seen from Ayton here over the course of this year, it's how he's basically seen certain matchups gone, okay, I need to adjust. I need to be more aggressive in this matchup. I need to scale it back in this matchup. He's pretty smart. So I'm very intrigued to see how he plays Lopez and how Lopez decides to work that game of chess right there.
Yeah, so let's go into the Phoenix side defensively against Milwaukee. I mean, again, we don't know when Giannis is returning, but once he does, we talked about this briefly the other day as well, the Suns don't seem to have a great answer for him defensively. So what would you do if you're Phoenix? How would you try to slow down Giannis?
Ayton, I guess, is the best part. Like, it's one of those things where you have someone, preferably Mikal Bridges, guard Giannis on the perimeter, and if Giannis gets the step, Ayton just leaves his cover immediately and goes into that matchup because that's the best that they have. Like, Jay Crowder is not going to slow down Giannis. Mm-hmm. Mikal Bridges alone is not going to slow down Giannis. It's unless, of course, Giannis isn't 100%, which we need to acknowledge is probably in the cards, at least initially, depending on when he returns. So we'll see. But you're right. There isn't that one guy you can say he's going to shut him down. This is going to be a team effort. It's going to be one of those things where they come in with a plan. They know exactly where who player is carrying the responsibility of Giannis when he's at the mid-range area, like the free throw line extended, if he's in the paint, if he's outside the three-point line. You have to know which players have that responsibility and then kind of rotate from there. And communication has to be key, this one. Like, for Phoenix, it's about screaming and yelling and like, recognizing patterns, because Giannis can get from point A to point B in a flash, and that means that they need to be very, very quick in their determination, and they need to be very, very quick in their communication. So that's going to trick them a lot initially, and then maybe by game 4 or 5 or whatever, maybe they've got an idea, and maybe they've just gotten so acquainted with Giannis that they know, okay, when he does A, we have to do B.
Right, right. I mean, they do have, I agree with you, that Ayton's probably their best option against him, but they do have some other big bodies they can at least throw his way occasionally between, you know, Jay Crowder, based on what he did in the last playoffs with Miami against Giannis.
Right.
You know, Cam Johnson, Dario Saric. We saw what Blake Griffin did in that Nets series, where it's just like, yeah, you're not going to stop him, but if you can just throw size in the paint, maybe you can draw a couple charges. Maybe you can force some, you know, him to take some of these like mid-range floaters, or, you know, don't let him get right to the rim, basically.
Right, right. Cam Johnson is an interesting name, I think, because he's got some length. He's bigger than what you think. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you watch him play, you can see there's a legit size there. But I wonder if he is sturdy enough, because he's not exactly built, if you catch my drift. Mm-hmm. There isn't a whole bunch of muscles on that frame, and I wonder if that's just going to be an open invitation for Giannis to drive it every single time he's on him, or maybe the length is enough. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we also don't know, even if Giannis plays, I mean, we saw this with Trae Young last night, like, you're out on the floor, but coming back from that injury, are you 100% already? Are you going to have the same type of burst and athleticism that you did prior to the injury? Because if not, like, if you can goad Giannis into taking those pull-up three-pointers or pull-up mid-range shots, that's a win every time. I don't care if he hits it. Like, openly encourage him to take that shot. You just don't want him getting directly to the rim. So,
yeah.
I think we'll see what his physical condition is, but I think in terms of personnel, Phoenix at least has some options to, you know, throw around and mix things up. I think you just, with any great player, you don't want them to get comfortable with what you're doing. You don't want them to know exactly who's going to be guarding them on every possession. I think Phoenix has the luxury of being able to change things on a possession-by-possession basis and try to keep him off kilter that way.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, let's look at it. You brought up Darius Saric. Mm-hmm. That's also an interesting name. There's Torrey Craig as well. Yeah. So you can realistically have a set of Ayton, Bridges, Crowder, Cameron Johnson, and Torrey Craig, and Darius Saric rotating on Giannis, which means maybe you don't beat him off of great individual defensive quality, but maybe you beat him off of just defensive quantity. Just having so many players who have their turn and really don't tire themselves out. So as soon as someone shows a little bit fatigue or been burned a couple times, all right, out you go. Someone else comes in. So you just tire Giannis out with new bodies all the time. Maybe that's the recipe.
Yeah. Yep. Totally agree there. Let's focus on now Drew and especially Chris Middleton, who had some mammoth performances in that Hawks series. You know, the Suns do have Mikal Bridges and Jay Crowder for Middleton. Which of those two guys, assuming Crowder isn't on Giannis, which of those two guys do you think is better suited to slow down Chris?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know if you can slow down Middleton to an extent where he's not a factor. I mean, he is so good at getting to his spots. His ball handling is, in my opinion, wildly underrated. So, I'm almost going to basically copy and paste my answer with Giannis. I think it has to be a team effort. I don't think you have one guy or two guys that needs to go on Chris. I think it needs to be one of those times where you rotate guys onto him instead. Maybe you should always just have two guys of the aforementioned, what was it, five players that I brought up on the court at all times that can guard either Middleton or Giannis and then take it from there, because I don't think, like, even if you put Bridges on him or Crowder on him, whatever, like, whoever it is, what are you trying to do with Middleton? Are you trying to get him off the spot? Okay, then you're going to need some size. That's probably going to be Crowder, just in terms of physicality. Mm-hmm. Do you want to challenge his shots? Then it's Bridges with his 7'1" wingspan. It really comes down to what you want to achieve, I think, with Middleton.
Yeah, I would lean Crowder because of the physicality. I think Bridges has gotten bodied a little bit in the playoffs. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that he needs to work on this offseason. You know, skill development, of course, but I think just, like, bulking up a little more.
Skill development, similar to one season, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I would lean Crowder whenever he isn't on Giannis. But that just speaks to the importance of Jay Crowder in this matchup, I think. You know, having to defend both of their top options and being one of the best weapons to do so. I mean, Jay Crowder...
And being able to hit threes.
Yeah, right. Well, he did in Game 6 of the Clippers series, right?
Yeah, but I'm talking about over the course of a full series. Yeah. Like, if he asserts himself defensively and he is gassed and those shots are coming up short, that's going to be an issue.
Yeah.
Like, this has to be a two-way performance by Jay Crowder throughout all seven games if we go that far.
Well, that's actually a good way to seg into. We can talk, you know, we know the stars on both of these teams. Giannis, Drew, Chris, CP3, Booker, Ayton. Let's talk about some potential X factors for each side. I think for Phoenix, it's probably Jay Crowder, right?
Yeah, like him or Mikal Bridges, I think.
Yeah, we are due for a big Bridges game. We haven't had one in a while.
Yeah, like, and he's shot 50% from the field or 51% from the field against the Clippers, but it was a low volume and he hasn't really looked all that confident. So I think he's one of those names as well. And then maybe also Cameron Payne is going to be an X factor, mm-hmm. like just coming in off the bench and putting up like, I don't know, 12-5, something along those lines. Like that's going to be a very necessary boost for them.
Yeah.
And honestly, when I look at the Suns roster, that's the one concern I have for them going into these finals, and it is offense. Do they have enough? Do they have enough to just generate those shots? Maybe, but I'm not entirely sure. Because like we've talked about this before with Jay Crowder being an inconsistent offensive performer. We've just talked about Mikal Bridges. There's also a significant ceiling to what Cam Johnson can do offensively. Cameron Payne is not a 20-point scorer, but he is a guy who comes in and produces in limited minutes. But he, too, has this tendency once in a while to just go MIA. So do you have enough in the main three of Booker, Ayton, and Paul to the point where you won't necessarily have to rely on the rest of them? I don't think so.
Yeah. No, Cameron Payne's a great shout, because if one thing got exposed, especially without Giannis and without Dante DiVincenzo, who it will go under the radar that he is missing from this Bucks team, but he provides better balance in the sense that without him, they have to go digging deeper into their bench just to fill out their starting lineup. And now their bench is just kind of flimsy. Like, I don't really trust anyone until Giannis comes back. Then Bobby Portis will probably move to the bench again, and I trust him. But, like, I trust Pat Connaughton. I don't trust Jeff Teague. Bryn Forbes has been hit or miss since that Miami series, but I don't know that I, you know, who stops Cameron Payne? Like, in the minutes that Drew or Chris is off the floor, and you're playing, like, if Bud goes with Jeff Teague against Cameron Payne is going to have a effing field day.
Can we just appreciate that we are going into an NBA Finals and you just said who can stop Cameron
Payne? I mean, considering how well he's played in the playoffs?
No, I agree with you, but can we just appreciate where we are?
The absurdity of Cameron Payne sudden. It's honestly like these are the finals that this pandemic season deserves.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. No, but you're right. You're right. I mean, basically, if things unfold the way we talked about here, Cameron Payne should have so many opportunities to take open shots and get himself involved offensively. As crazy as this sounds, Cameron Payne could be the player who determines the outcome of an NBA Finals series. And I'm not even joking. This is just where we are. This is, oh my God, this is insane. I love it. I love this so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, my X factor moving to Milwaukee, more like Bobby Portis, sure, PJ Tucker, yeah, sure, but like it might be Mike Budenholzer.
Oh, now you're cheating going with a non-player. That's fair. I agree with that. Well, yeah, if Mike Budenholzer has a good series and actually shows that he is an elite coach, for which he hasn't so far, yeah, I would agree that he's probably going to be the difference maker.
Right, because like Monty Williams is going, I mean, going into these finals, I've been saying this for a while, but I really genuinely believe Monty Williams versus Bud is the biggest mismatch in this series.
I don't disagree with you. Yeah, Monty Williams, I think, is going to coach the pants off of Bud at least one or two games.
Right, and I mean, that's all it takes. Like, we saw in game two of that Clippers-Suns series, where you draw up the alley-oop, and that's the difference between winning that game and losing that game. And like the Clippers, despite being without Kawhi, instead of going down 3-1, very easily could have been up 3-1 in that series. Like the margins are so thin when you get this deep into the playoffs and your teams are this evenly matched. So you know, if Mike Budenholzer messes around with Jeff Teague minutes against Cameron Payne and Cameron Payne lights him up for like 8 quick points, that doesn't sound like a lot, and maybe that's not the story of the game. But again, like it every single possession matters, and these things build up over time. So
yeah, they do.
How Bud? I mean, like, the answer might be Drew just needs to play all 48 minutes, but I don't think he's going to do that, at least at the start of the series.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. I think the main difference between Bud and Monty Williams is really that Monty isn't afraid to do things. Like, he's got some guts. I think Bud is a little bit more conservative in the sense that, you know, well, let's scale it back. Let's go back to norm. Like, let's not really be all that progressive and active in doing something. Whereas Monty is just, hey, you know what? I'm seeing a chance to do something crazy. Let's go for it. And I think sometimes that mentality is your best friend because it forces you to think differently. It catches your opponent off guard. So it's going to be very, very, very exciting to see moving forward which of the two is going to come out and lay it all out on the floor. Because these are the NBA Finals, baby. You don't get a chance to play timid.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess the concern from Phoenix's end in that regard is, like, do they get so overhyped about, like, this is our best chance to win Chris Paul a ring? But I don't think so. I think Monty will keep his team more level-headed. Whereas, because, I mean, the Bucks are going to have the same thing. Like, we can finally win Giannis a ring. We can finally win Drew a ring. We can finally win Chris a ring. So, you know, there's that newcomer aspect for both sides here. It's not like this is LeBron James' 11th finals and we can win him his 5th ring. Like, who gives a damn? You know, both teams are going to be hyped up to that extent going into this series.
I don't think anyone on the rosters have a championship ring. I think NBA's Twitter put up something about
that. Oh, really?
I'm pretty certain that no player on either roster has a championship
ring. Wow. Oh, that's interesting. Huh. All right. Well, that could be another thing, too. Like, which coach has their team more ready for this stage?
Right.
Because, you know, it's when the whistle blows, it's still just a basketball game, but we see it oftentimes, especially early in series, like you just get so swept up in everything that's around the finals. This is, you know, we're 4 wins away. I trust Monty again more than I do Bud in that regard.
Yeah. Can we just appreciate as well, though, that this became a Milwaukee Phoenix series and not, you know, Los Angeles, Brooklyn, for example, like that we've all heard all the big market slander for so long. We've all heard the Knicks fans and Lakers fans going on and on and on about all their advantages and how great they are, yada, yada, yada. And now we have a team from Wisconsin, a team from Arizona going at it. I mean, you know what? I appreciate that. I love that. That is what's great about this league, I think, where talent wins out. That talent doesn't care about market. If you're the better team, you're going to make it. And right now, we're seeing two teams that have just been so impressive all year long, and they're at the mountaintop right now trying to figure out just who's going to take that final step. I absolutely love this so much.
So let's go into prediction time, Mort. The Phoenix Suns, according to FanDuel, are slightly favored to win this series. They are minus 175. The Bucks are plus 140. I'm assuming that is in large part due to the uncertainty over Giannis. I would guess if you knew Giannis was healthy and going into game one, the Bucks would probably be slight favors in this series. Who do you see winning and in how many games?
Yeah, so I am in line with what you just said. So if Giannis was fully healthy, 100% healthy for the entirety of the series, I'm going Milwaukee in probably 6. But if he's not, like if he misses at least a couple of games, and then if he's back, he's playing like 40%, 50%, 60% of what he is, then I think it goes Phoenix in 6. I would definitely be very shocked to see, you know, half a version of Giannis make it all the way through. So that's basically where I am. I know I'm not picking something with absolute certainty here, but we also have to realize that we're in a pretty weird spot with Giannis not really knowing where he's at. So that's going to be my answer. With a healthy Giannis, Bucks in six. If not, Suns in six.
I think I would lean Suns in six either way.
That's interesting. Yeah, and you know what? I'm not even going to fight that because I could see it. That wouldn't shock me. Like, honestly, the only thing that would shock me in this series is a sweep.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that would shock me.
Yeah. I think these teams are pretty evenly matched. I think it's going to be a great series. Again, this is like the absolute nightmare scenario from a TV executive standpoint, but it shouldn't be. Like, this is, we're going to hear nothing but, like, market talk for the next 2 weeks. And it's stupid because, like, just because these teams are from Phoenix and Milwaukee, we have the two-time MVP. We have one of the greatest point guards in NBA history. We have a young rising star in Devin Booker. We have, like, incredible all-star caliber, you know, I don't want to say role players, but, like, sidekicks in Middleton and Drew Holiday. We have DeAndre Ayton, who is becoming one of the best young centers in the game. Like, there are so many great players here. Let's build these guys up instead of just, like, crying that LeBron and Steph aren't in the finals.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Like, I like seeing new blood. Trae Young, you know, like, hit this run through the playoffs for the Hawks, that we'll get to shortly, was awesome. Like, it was super fun. I don't remember a fun storyline like this for a while, just because it's been the same names over and over again. But if you want to attract more fan interest and, like, you know, establish more parity, which the NBA ostensibly wants to do, this is the way to do it.
Yep. I completely agree. For crying out loud, I've been writing about this for 4 years.
Yeah, so yeah, that's true. So before we move on to the Bye Felicias, I also want to hit on NBA Finals MVP. If you had to choose right now. So these odds are also from FanDuel. Chris Paul is currently the favorite at plus 170. Devin Booker is plus 270. Giannis is plus 350. Middleton plus 650. Holiday plus 1,000. After that, Ayton's plus 2,500. And Brooke Lopez plus 13,000. You could please go with the wild card of Brooke Lopez MVP finals MVP.
Can we talk about something? Because let's say that Phoenix is going to win this series, and let's say that Devin Booker has played objectively better.
Ooh, yeah.
I still feel like Chris Paul is going to win it because it's going to be legacy thing and whatnot. And like we've already seen in 2015 how Andre Iguodala won the Finals MVP over Steph, which was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It was so dumb. Is it fair to go that route? I mean, what if Devin Booker never makes it back to the NBA Finals after this year? And let's say he was the best player in the finals, should have won that MVP, mm-hmm. and didn't. It just seems to me that is unfair that you want to go with a narrative or legacy, because you and I agree that it would seem like that NBA media members could pick Chris Paul just because of legacy issues or factors.
I think it would have to, like, it's hard to say now going into the series. Like, if Devin Booker so soundly outplayed Chris Paul, if Chris Paul was, like, terrible and they won in spite of him, which I don't think is going to happen. But, you know, if he's, like, fine but doesn't have one of these 40-point just absolutely tears a team apart for a game, and Booker is, like, going off for 40-plus every game. Like, I think if there's that big of a gap, the media will rightfully give Devin Booker MVP. But I agree with you that if it's close, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the intangibles end up pushing people to Chris Paul. Like, Chris Paul's leadership is what won him the MVP or what won this team the finals.
I'm just saying, if Devin Booker ends up averaging, you know, like 28-6-6 and has like a true shooting percentage of 60. Mm-hmm. And Paul is like 17 points, 8 assists, 5 rebounds or something along those lines. And it goes to Paul. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we'll have to see how it plays out. I think I'm not surprised that he is the favorite to win it going into the series for the narrative reasons especially. And also just, you know, the way Booker's been kind of struggling since he broke his nose 15 times. In terms of efficiency, at least.
Right.
And I think you know, it's just going to be interesting to see how, again, like, I don't think the Bucks have a great answer for Booker unless it's Drew, whereas I think, you know, Drew on Chris, or Giannis on Chris, as you mentioned earlier, could work to pretty well. So, it feels like if anyone's going to win from just pure on-court perspective, Booker is probably a better bet than Paul. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the narrative. And same with Giannis and Middleton. Like, Giannis has better odds than Middleton right now. But we just saw what Middleton can do without Giannis. He has these monster quarters, monster halves. If Giannis isn't fully healthy, again, if he plays but he's not like his MVP self, they're going to have to lean more heavily on that supporting cast. You know, Middleton at plus 650 might not be the craziest bet right now.
I agree with you. I mean, honestly, I'm at the point where I think next year the Bucks should start experimenting with putting the ball into Chris Middleton's hands and make him the key decision maker instead of Giannis. Not saying you're diminishing Giannis's role by any stretch. You're just retooling it. Mm-hmm. You're changing it. But I completely agree with you. If 60% of Giannis is there and they win that series, which I would be surprised if they did under those circumstances, then Chris Middleton should be racing the Bill Russell Award up.
Yeah. Do you see a scenario where a player from the losing team could still win MVP? Like, what if the Bucks win but Chris Paul's still MVP?
Oh, God, I would be so upset. I would be so upset. No, we had that thing with LeBron a couple years ago where that was a legitimate conversation, I think. Yeah. And I'm still glad it didn't happen. I still think that's a weird one, honestly.
Yeah.
I think the only reason that it was a split opinion was because it was LeBron. Like, all the LeBron fans came out and said, I think this is a great idea.
Right.
But no, I think it needs to be from the winning side, absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree, unless, again, like, unless it is just such a monster performance. And
yeah, like 50, 20, and 20, then we can talk about it, right. You know?
But I don't see that from anyone on either side.
Right, agreed.
All right, well, finals start Tuesday. We will have plenty of coverage of them once they do begin. But we have to say goodbye to two teams now.
We do.
Let's start with Atlanta, since this is so fresh in our memory. They, you know, had an incredible run in these playoffs. I mean, people were picking against them in the Knicks series, which I still don't understand. Like, no one expected them to make it to the Eastern Conference Finals. And the good thing for them is that most of their team is under contract for next season. Like, things will get tough eventually, and we'll get to that shortly, but you know, you're running back Gallinari, Bogdanovic, Clint Capella, Trae Young, DeAndre Hunter, Onyeka Okongwu, who had some great games in the playoffs, Cam Reddish, Kevin Huerter, all under contract for 21-22 already. So that alone.
No Bruno Fernando?
Bruno. How could I forget Bruno Fernando? I'm sorry, Bruno. that alone is a great rotation. The big question, of course, is John Collins, who is a restricted free agent this summer. Probably, I mean, he turned down a extension worth about $90 million heading into the year. I think that was from Chris Kirshner and Sam Amick of The Athletic. Probably ended up being a good decision based on, you know, kind of the season they had and how he played in the playoffs. If you're the Hawks, how much are you willing to go up to re-sign John Collins?
Again, I mean, you and I have had this discussion, I think, 10 times by now. I am just not sold on a guy who needs to be set up by others almost exclusively. I mean, look, 77.5% of Collins's made field goals this year were assisted. So he's not someone who can self-create. Let's say Trae Young goes down with an injury. Knock on wood, that doesn't happen. Like, who's there to create for John Collins? You can't give him the ball at, like, the elbow and say, hey, go create. He's not that kind of player.
Well, I mean, you can, but it's just not going to be a super efficient form of offense.
Correct. It's not going to be what you want it to be, right? So it's one thing if he was one of those guys who, like, Phoenix Amari Stoudemire, you know what I mean? Where it was like 26 per game, 20 points, or 26 points per game, 10 plus rebounds, like the pick and roll offense that just completely devastates everything. And to be fair, he has some of that in him. But like I would want to see more before I was like, okay, I need to max this guy. I would probably look at around 20 million as my max. When I go into like the stats and I look into contractual worth of other players as well, especially these multi-purpose wings, I just don't value John Collins to the same extent. I mean, he's almost exclusively a four. Mm-hmm. Like we're in a league right now where positional fluidity is a term. Positionless basketball is a frequent discussion point. And here we have one guy who has to be pigeonholed into one position because he can't really play center, can't play the three, he's a four. And not having that positional flexibility for someone who needs to receive, what, 30 plus minutes per game, I think that could limit you. So I'm not ready to break the bank for John Collins. And I would even feel a little bit rough with 20 million a year. And I realize that not a lot of people share that belief that I have. I know a lot of people are like, more, you know what, there's still room in the NBA for power forwards. All right, great. I completely disagree with you, but that's fine. I don't think the traditional power forward has any merit left in the NBA. I think that's dead and buried, and I think it should be, given that how there are far superior options out there. I think there's a reason that the teams currently in the NBA finals are multi-positional players, like Jay Crowder used to be A3. Giannis has literally played every single position on the hardwood. And while many would label him a four, he's a basketball player who can play virtually 1 through 5. He is as positionless as they come, and he has no weakness in terms of playmaking, ball handling, defense, rebounding. So I think this is where we're looking moving forward. I think having players who are pigeonholed into one position is going to be a net negative for most teams. And I look at John Collins, despite the fact that I like John Collins very much, as being one of those guys. And you know, I talked up this guy when before he got drafted. Yeah. I love him. I do not dislike the player John Collins. I just think the archetype of player that he is somewhat dead. And I think that should be reflected in price. If he signs for somewhere along the lines of 16, 18 million, then I could get behind it. But I don't think he will. I think it's going to be substantially more.
Yeah, if he gets a max, I don't. I think Atlanta is going to match whatever he gets. Or they're at least sending that signal, according to I think it was Windhorst and Bontemps were reporting that back in March. So I think they don't want to lose him for nothing.
Right. I don't think they max, though. I don't think they match a max.
Maybe they try to negotiate a sign-in trade at that point.
Yes. That they should do. Yeah. Because they have their future, and I'm putting this in quotation marks, for in DeAndre Hunter,
right,
who is that type of player.
Right.
And frankly, I would rather have DeAndre Hunter playing that spot. I would rather have... Like the Hawks have the potential to be one of the teams in the league with the most positional flexibility players.
Yes.
Like outside of Trae Young, and you know what? It's fine if you have a one position player who's a ball handler,
right,
and creator. Like that doesn't matter. You can build around him in every capacity you want. But like Kevin Huerter can play two positions. DeAndre Hunter can play two positions. Onyeka Okongwu, while probably more so a center than a four, can still play the four. Like, there's also some multiple position thing in there. And Clint Capela, sure, he's a center through and through, but you know what? He's also paid to be just that. And the center position hasn't died. As long as you can play defense, as long as you can dive to the rim as a center, you have value. Mm-hmm. And he is also not grotesquely paid. He's actually on a very reasonable contract. Danilo Gallinari can play multiple positions. I mean, Cameron Reddish, in theory, can play three positions. We're looking maybe even four, because his ball handling projects as being really good. Mm-hmm. There's just so much to like with the Hawks in terms of their positional fluidity. But also maybe they make that argument that because we have so many multiple positional players, we can afford to have one in John Collins who isn't. Maybe that's something they're discussing internally. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's as simple as you have Young at one, Capella at 5, and then you can mix and match Bogdanovich, Herder, Reddish, and Hunter interchangeably almost as your three wings slash forward slash whatever the hell you want to call them. It doesn't matter, but you're totally right. I mean, they can go as positionless as they want. And I think the presence of Hunter should at least give them pause about matching a max. I think some team will probably throw that offer out there just because the free agent class is so depleted. I know the Spurs have come up repeatedly as a potential Collins destination, and I actually do like that fit. Do I think Atlanta would be smart to match a max and keep John Collins on that contract for the duration of it? No, but I also don't think you want to lose John Collins for nothing. So ideally, I think you're right. If you can get him back at a lower price, I'm looking at ProfitX that has projections for the next 3 years. So they're saying over the next three seasons, he's going to be worth about $68.5 million, which is probably about $6-7 million per year below what he would earn on a max deal. If you can get him, next year's starting salary would be $22.9 million. That's even a little high for me, but fine. Like, if you can get him at that instead of, $28-29 million, then I'm more open to it, because he's a type of guy who you might be able to flip for value later, too. So even if you're lukewarm on keeping him for the duration of that contract, given the way the rest of your salary shakes out, they could match that contract and still be nowhere near the luxury tax next year and kind of punt that decision down the road to 2022, which is where things start to get very hairy for them financially.
Yeah. I will say this. I don't think he had a great year in the regular season. I think there was so much roster turnover, people angling for minutes, angling for shots. He went 4 points down per game, on a per game average, almost 3 rebounds down as well. And he saw a minutes decrease by 4 minutes. Like, he saw less shot attempts. If, let's say, his baseline were what he did in his third year, which was 21.5 points, 10 plus rebounds, over a block and a half, 80 from the line, 40 from three, and almost, over 58% from the field overall. Okay, let's say that was his baseline and he built upon that moving forward. Yes, then I would argue that type of money you just brought up would make a lot of sense, because then you would have basically an assassin who can go out and get you points, and then it doesn't matter what position he plays. You bring him into the game for one reason, to put up numbers, whether that's points, rebounds, three pointers, doesn't matter. Just efficiency and production. And then when the game slows down and it's in the late stages, that's when you sit his ass down. That's when you bring in DeAndre Hunter. That's when you go positionless instead. So you more or less make him a three-quarter player.
Yeah. I mean, he spoke repeatedly this year about how he had to sacrifice. He put up 20-10 over the last two seasons because he was playing for a crappy team, and he was willing to take a step back in terms of his touches and his shot attempts this year because they added so much talent in free agency. But then that also begs the question, if you did, he is taking this step back in terms of production, should you be paying him a max deal or anywhere near a max deal? Because you don't need him to produce in that role or to that extent. You want him, I don't want to say a role player necessarily, but, Trae Young is very clearly the focal point of your team. And then after that, you're kind of just divvying up touches between all of these other guys. Bogdanovich, Herder, Hunter.
Bogdanovich. I forgot to bring up Bogdanovich. He can also play multiple
positions. Yeah, exactly. it's going to be... that's the trickiest decision the Hawks have by far this offseason. Yeah. What to do with John Collins, how much to pay for him. The other... now they have to also, in context of the Collins decision, they need to be looking ahead beyond 21-22, because there's a real argument to pay him to just match whatever and you can run this thing back. But then in 22, Trae Young, I mean, he and Kevin Huerter become eligible for extensions this summer. Trae Young is so clearly getting a max that it's not even worth discussing. He's going to get the designated rookie language. So if he makes an all-NBA team, he'll get 30% of the cap. But Huerter, I think, is...
Can I just interject and say that there seems to be some buzz on Twitter about how Trae Young shouldn't get a max, and I'm laughing my ass off of that.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I've seen that a lot.
In what world? Like, even if the Hawks had hesitation after this playoff...
Oh, I know.
Or, like, before the playoffs, this playoff run ended it.
Well, the argument is even more laughable.
Oh, boy.
Because you know how I harbored on this?
It's the lack of teams.
Yeah, right.
Like, sometimes you just need to ignore that part. I mean, we're talking about a 25-10 guy. Well, 9.5. His numbers over the past 2 years have been ridiculous. No, I agree with you, of course.
Yeah, I mean...
I just wanted to point that
out. Like, I think it could have been fair. Like, this playoff run, I think, was very instructive for Atlanta. Because if you didn't see Trae Young in the playoffs over the first 3 years, and you have to weigh whether to give him a max deal, I think you still do it without question.
Yeah.
But you might be a little nervous. Like, how does it translate to the playoffs when, you know, you're more in a half-court setting... And teams really start to, like, pick on mismatches. Do teams just continually target him? And maybe personnel-wise, the teams the Hawks faced during the playoffs weren't suited very well to do that. Like, maybe if the Hawks play Brooklyn in round two, Kyrie Irving just roasts Trae Young alive for the entire series and the Hawks go home. And now all of a sudden, you do have to worry about that. But I think he proved to be such an elite offensive option that you just don't worry about his, like, yeah, do you want him to be a better defender? Of course you do. But you're still giving this guy a max contract because he is the lifeblood of your offense. And he, you know, he proved, despite his defensive deficiencies, that he can get you very far in the playoffs. So I have no hesitation if I'm Atlanta giving him a max deal. So many guys who are worse than Trae Young have gotten max deals. Like, this is, beyond Luka, he's like the easiest no-brainer in the class, I think.
Of course he is. Look, I mean, the Sixers have PTSD but just by watching the free-for-all.
But Huerter, I think, is the more interesting discussion because he's also eligible for the extension. And so if you're the Hawks and you max Trae Young, you match a max for John Collins this offseason, you're like really close to luxury tax territory next year. Before you even factor in a Huerter extension. So that's what I mean when I say they have to take the long approach here as well. Like, right. 2022 is where things get really tricky for them if they want to keep all of these young guys together. So what do you think? I mean, A, if you're Atlanta, do you even give Huerter an extension this offseason? Or what do you think a fair price point would be for him?
I honestly consider package him with someone else for something bigger. I think the Hawks are in a great position to make a consolidation trade. Yes. I made that point before. Yep. Because they just have that many different players. It's almost a shame that they didn't do that before with John Collins, I think. Because I just don't think it going into restricted free agency with guys who have an unset value, I don't think that's smart for teams. I think that's an issue. Because you may have to overpay. So that means you're looking at a situation where right now you can't just trade John Collins. He would have to agree to a sign and trade. So that's out of the table. That means if you're going to trade Kevin Huerter, you need to package him with what? Cam Reddish, Onyeka Okongwu, like DeAndre Hunter. But then that return has to be insane, though. Mm-hmm. But I do think that just the sheer bodies that they have on this team, it would make sense if they went shopping this year. And that's not to say I don't like Kevin Huerter. I like Kevin Huerter a lot. I think he's got the potential to be one of the better three-point shooters in this league, especially when the confidence level is high. He seems to be a bit of a confidence player, mm-hmm. but that confidence also seems to rise up more and more. So I like him overall, but I'm not looking at him as a necessary building block.
Yeah.
He's expendable if push came to shove. And if you can upgrade the roster around Trae Young, which is the point of everything, then you do it. And I realize, what do you need to put alongside Trae Young? You need shooting. What does Kevin Huerter have? Shooting. yes, that's great. But if you can make that a little bit more interesting, maybe the guy you get in return is a two-way player. Maybe the guy you can get in return also is a bit of a rebounder. Maybe you get someone who's near all-star level. You know, I don't know who that player is necessarily, but there are definitely situations out there in the NBA that you can go explore. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens, but I would definitely be open to moving Kevin Huerter and probably a couple of other pieces to see what I could get in the open market this year.
Yeah.
Or not in the open market, in the trade market, of course.
Right, yeah. So I just wrote a piece, or I published it just minutes before we started recording, kind of looking at the long-term view for Atlanta, because I think it's really tough to keep this title window open beyond the 21-22 season, just given all of these competing factors and, like, how much are they willing to pay up? Because, you know, in 22, even if you re-sign Collins, give Trey a max, give Huerter an extension or re-sign him, you can make more space. You can waive Gallinari. He's only got $5 million guaranteed in the 22-23 season. So that's not, you know, not the end of the world there. But then Bogdanovich, he can decline his player option in 23. It's $18 million. Capella's a free agent in 23. So, like, they're in the stage of team building where they have so many guys on rookie contracts that it was easy for them to add talent like Gallinari, like Bogdanovich, like Capella. I know they got Capella via trade, but, you know, signed Bogdanovich and Gallinari. Right. When these young guys get off these rookie contracts, not only will they not have cap space, but they're going to go way into the luxury tax. So they have to, you know, they're going to start losing pieces here in the next, after the 21-22 season. But I agree with you. I think a consolidation trade is probably their best path out of just this financial boondoggle where they're, like, they're going to end up losing talent just because they can't afford to pay everyone. So, yeah. You know, like, Bradley Beal, I think, will be a popular name mentioned if you can, like, trade.
You and I have brought up Bradley Beal in connection with Atlanta before.
Yeah, but I wonder, we'll get to the Clippers in a minute, but, like, if Kawhi leaves and the Clippers decide to rebuild and are looking to move off of Paul George, you could do, like, Huerter, Reddish, and Gallinari, and then a pick or two for Paul George.
Yeah, I mean, that would be filthy, but at the same time, does Paul George fit the Trae Young timeline as well?
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing they're going to have to balance here. I mean, Bradley Beal is young enough. He's only 27, I want to say.
Is he only that? I thought he was a bit
older. I know, he's been in the league forever, but I think he's actually surprisingly young.
He's 28.
Okay, 28. Oh, he just turned 28.
Yeah. But still, like, you're right. He's younger than you might expect. Like, he's still got a solid 4 years left of his prime.
Right.
Like, yeah, that would be interesting to me. Are there anyone out there who's younger? Like, maybe someone who's just stepped into his rookie extension time, or maybe someone who's very close to being, like, oh, you're laughing already. Who are you thinking?
Well, Ben Simmons is available.
Well, someone who can shoot.
Yeah. I mean, that's Brandon Ingram. But I don't think the Pelicans want to take that step back.
No, I don't think so either, but that's an interesting name. Like, that is honestly interesting. Someone of that ilk. Mm-hmm. Like, someone who isn't quite a superstar, but who is, you know, an all-star here and there. Like, he was an all-star this year, he was last year. Someone who can hit from outside, who's got size. That's not a bad name to bring out there. And I agree with you. I don't think the Pelicans do anything to move him right now, but someone of that ilk could definitely be fun.
Or
what about...
If the Celtics decided to, you know, really... Like, if the Horford thing doesn't work out and they just really need to... Like, Marcus Smart's going to leave. They're going to retool a bit around Tatum. What about Jaylen Brown?
No, I think Tatum and Brown are a package.
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't do it. Like, I'm actually going to go as far as saying I do not think the Celtics should even involve Jaylen Brown in a Dame thing.
Oh.
I think those two guys are on the similar timeline, Tatum and Brown. I think it would be ridiculous to separate those two, especially because they play two of the most crucial positions that lead the one crucial position, which is wing.
Right.
And they're interchangeable. Like, both of those two guys can cover three positions. So I'm just not interested in moving that around. And plus, Jaylen Brown gets better every single year by a substantial margin. Or amount. So I'm just not interested in doing that. Yeah, see, it's difficult. Like, who is out there where you can really consolidate? There is one name, though.
Siakam?
Yeah, no. He's also up there. Well,
he's 27, there. He's 27, yeah.
But there is one name that I keep circling to. But again, it would also depend on the team having to basically say, you know what? Screw it. We're pivoting into something else. Karl-Anthony Towns.
Ooh.
A Trae Young, Karl-Anthony Towns, like, roster, just starting with those two and building from there. That would be interesting. If Minnesota were open to pivoting into a full-on rebuild, I mean, you could send them so many fun things.
Yeah.
And draft picks, of course.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
But that would be fun.
That's kind of where Atlanta is. Like, again, you don't have to make any of these moves or any of these decisions until the 22-23 season. So if you think, like, this wasn't a fluke and that you think you are going to be in that top tier of title contender next year, just run it back and punt these problems until later. But, like, these are on the horizon. Like, this, my piece today at Forbes is, like, this title window might not be as open as long as you would think for a team comprised of mostly 20-something guys. Mostly guys in their young 20s. Yeah. It's just, like, you're going to have to... You know, how they handle all of these individual decisions from here will determine whether Atlanta has staying power beyond next season or whether this is more of a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I think if you have Trae Young, it's not going to be a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I think they're going to be a clear playoff team for a while.
Yeah.
For sure.
But this is like the deal for me, just a Towns caliber deal. I think that's the play. Right, like where you really swing on a tremendous talent,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, sure, to the point where you actually may come out of the deal afterwards going, "Ooh, we gave up a lot," but at the same time, you would have two players who, at least on paper, conceptually, would fit together so well.
Yeah. The last question about Atlanta: Nate McMillan was the interim coach. Do you think there's any way he's not back next year?
I mean, it's funny, right? Because you and I have been skeptical of Nate McMillan for a while because he's one of those guys who slows the game down a lot and really seems to be leaning more defense than offense. And when he got the tag this time around, we were a little bit, Nate McMillan for Trae Young? How does that work out? It did. I still have no explanation for how he just decided to pivot, but he did. And maybe this was a Nate McMillan, you know, moment of self-realization, just him going, hey, you know what? I realize what I have in terms of weapons on the roster, mm-hmm. and if I play into that hand, I stand a better chance of making a run in the playoffs. And it certainly seemed like that was the case. So, yeah, I'm thinking he's absolutely back. I would be shocked if he wasn't. I mean, look at the results. What possible argument could you have if you're the Atlanta Hawks not to return him?
Yeah, and from everything I've read throughout this playoff run, it sounds like Nate's time with the Pacers caused him to do some self-reflection. He was there was an Athletic article. I apologize in advance because I don't remember who wrote it. I would guess Chris Kirshner.
We have a lot of colleagues, Brian. We can't
tell. Yeah. But it was about like the old, quote-unquote, the old Nate and the new Nate. Whereas like the old Nate would have lost his mind with this certain situation, but the new Nate realizes, like, I just have to relate to players in a different way. I was reading an article today on The Athletic about how Cam Reddish and Lloyd Pierce never really saw eye to eye, but then McMillan came in, formed a quick connection with Reddish, and, you know, Reddish gets hurt right away, doesn't play really at all. I think he played 3 regular season games under McMillan, but then you see he comes back in this Bucks series, and look what he did in game 6. I mean, you know, like he looks And McMillan was comparing him to Paul George. So I brought up Paul George earlier as a potential trade target. Like, the Hawks might not, even if they start losing some of this ancillary talent, if you keep Trae Young, Cam Reddish, and DeAndre Hunter together, and they continue building like they have, building on their respective games like they have over these first two seasons, like, this Hawks team is going to be better next year because they have a healthy Reddish and a healthy Hunter. Hunter, like, you know, he didn't play a ton in the playoffs, but he was really freaking good at the start of this season. He was, like, one of the only bright spots for the Hawks for the first 20 games of the season. And they did get...
He's their second best player.
Yeah. So, like, you know, they have some incredible young talent. Like, when I'm saying, you know, they have to be mindful of the long-term future, like, this is just kind of the challenge of roster building. And I think it's a fun problem for, well, maybe not fun for him, but like a fun thought process for the rest of us. Travis Schlenk probably doesn't love his job after this year. But, you know, I mean, they have just so much good young talent that for the next year or two, if they continue on this trajectory, like, I don't see any reason the Hawks couldn't be back in this situation. Like, would I pick them over a fully healthy Brooklyn or Milwaukee team right now going into next year? Maybe not, but we also don't know. Like, we talked about Brooklyn already, how they're supporting cast. If they can keep Bruce Brown, Blake Griffin, Jeff Green, if not, do they downgrade? Because the Hawks supporting cast is going to stay strong. Like, they're going to still be one of the deepest teams in the NBA next year, and they have so many young guys who have already shown promising flashes on big stages. Like, freaking Ogunquu was a monster throughout some of these playoff games. He showed a ton of promise. I'm extremely bullish on the Hawks moving forward in the short term, and I am just so fascinated with how they juggle all of these competing priorities beyond next season.
I would not be shocked if by the end of next season, with 1 year left on his contract, Clint Capella is traded. Because at that point in time, Onyeka Okongwu has just proven to be the superior option because he's got more offensive game, and, you know, obviously he's not as great of a rebounder or shot blocker, but I think overall he projects as a very, very capable two-way guy. At that point in time, Trae Young is also a year older. DeAndre Hunter would be in his third year. Cam Reddish would be in his third year. Maybe that's the play. And then if you get something good for Collins in a sign-and-trade scenario this summer... Mm-hmm. I mean, good Lord, maybe you just swing on the upside of the youth and then you pay. Maybe that's the play. You just say, you know what? All right, we have these. We understand now that Onyeka Okongwu, Cam Reddish, DeAndre Hunter, and Trae Young is our future, our future. Mm-hmm. So let's just run with them, and then we'll let Danilo Gallinari expire. We're going to let Bogdan Bogdanovic, you know, test out the market when he's a free agent or whatever. Maybe they just play it out so they're competitive in the meantime, and by 2023, Gallinari, Bogdanovic, and Capello simply aren't on the roster anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of talent to lose for nothing, but it's certainly an option.
They could also trade them, yeah, of course, right. But I'm just saying, like, but the thing is, if you trade them, you probably have to match salary. Like, who would take on a Danilo Gallinari 20.4 million in raw cap space?
Right.
For this year, for example, I don't think anyone does that. And that ups to, well, it's only a partial guarantee for 2022, 2023, but I don't know. You can probably get off of Bogdan, though. Definitely get someone to absorb his 18 million, absolutely, and probably get them back a pick or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem is, like, if you're trading these guys for players rather than picks, you're still bringing salary back. Like, at some point, this roster is just going to become prohibitively expensive.
And yes. And that's why I keep going back to the consolidation trade.
Right. I think that is the play. And, like, the good thing for the Hawks is that having Gallinari, Bogdanovic, Capella, they have some of those, like, mid-tier salary matching chips where it's not like, you know, you're not going to get Russell Westbrook on a $40 million contract, but you also don't want Russell Westbrook on a $40 million contract. You've got some of those guys who you can... And, like, that could be another reason to re-sign John Collins as well. It could just be another one of those, you know, especially if he's not on a max deal, another one of those, like, 20-ish million salary matching contracts to attach some of these young guys to bring in a Bradley Beal or someone else.
Or he could be the main cog in a return for Karl-Anthony Towns because the Wolves like John Collins.
There you go. Yeah, the Hawks are... I'm just so interested to see where they go from here. Because, like, the future looks astoundingly bright right now. But if there's ever been... I mean, look back to OKC a couple years ago. Like, the challenge becomes when you have to start paying all of these extremely talented young players. And, like, we thought OKC was going to be a dynasty. And then, you know, we know what happened. So... Atlanta had an incredible run. I think they will be even better next year. What they look like in 2022 and beyond just endlessly fascinates me.
Agreed.
All right, so let's wrap up with the Los Angeles Clippers, Mort, who have the biggest, it's not even a decision, but the biggest free agent on the market is Kawhi Leonard. He, you know, misses a lot of time in the playoffs with this knee injury that we still have no clarity on. We saw reports that it is some version of an ACL injury. We don't know the severity. We don't know if he's going to be ready for 21-22. We know nothing. He has a, I believe it's $36 million player option for the 21-22 season. So there's a chance that he just picks that up and then it's not a decision at all. He just run it back and no worries. But what's your read on Kawhi, Mort? Because I know there have been reports already that teams like the Mavs and the Heat in particular are hoping to make a pitch for him.
29 teams should want to make a pitch for him. That's not the point. The point is what he wants to do. And if this ACL injury, whether it's a tear or a strain, I don't even know what kind of subsection there is under ACL injuries, but regardless, just the word or the letters ACL in that order, it's pretty terrifying. So, like, if he picks up his $36 million player option, that to me indicates that his health probably isn't as great. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, why would you do that instead of maxing yourself out? Because if memory serves, he is now a 10-year vet. He is now a 10-year vet. So he is eligible for 35% of the cap. Meaning he should definitely opt out and sign long-term. But if the injury has shaken it out to be, you know, a non-factor, I guess we'll see. Mm-hmm. But no, I think he wants to stay home, right? I mean, he wanted to be in LA. He because that's where he's from. Yeah, he didn't, like, he even won a ring in Toronto and still bolted, right? Because nope, I want to go home. I get that he's a guy who's tough to get a proper read on, and I also get that Uncle Dennis plays a role behind the scenes, but I would be pretty shocked if he's not back.
Yeah, I would as well. They only have early bird on him, right? Because he signed as a free agent. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, it's only 2 years. You're absolutely right.
But
so if he picks this up, they'll have full bird rights in 2022, but that's still such a risk.
Yeah. Oh, but they can... Okay, no, he can still, because they have early bird, he can get 170. See, so he can get a full max still.
It's 175. Yeah, okay, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, if he opts out, he can get, in terms of, this is $112.4 million salary cap is what the projection has been. So if he opts out from his own team, from the Clippers, he can get a 5-year, $228.2 million contract. If he opts out, signs with another team, the most they can offer is 4 years. It's $169.2 million.
Yeah.
So almost a $60 million difference. yeah, I mean, if you're the Clippers, I feel like if he opts out and he's willing to take the 5-year max, you have to do it. But are you a little bit nervous about that knee moving forward?
Of course. Of course I am. Like, if I signed that contract with him as the Clippers, I would almost just be covering my eyes about the knee and just saying, look at his upside when he's healthy. Because when he's healthy, he's at the very least a top five NBA player, if not top three. He is phenomenal. One of the best two-way forwards we've ever seen, to be quite honest with you. I mean, I love how people are comparing him to Scottie Pippen, not realizing that he's better than Scottie ever was, that is immensely humorous to me. Like, somehow he would have been the Scottie Pippen of the 90s. He's so much better. Like, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. I think you have to look at the upside of him being healthy and just cover your eyes and hope for the best. But no, that knee and that thigh, and there are a lot of concerns with that. Like, just his body overall. Like, if you sign him to that contract and he Grant heals you, then you're stuck and you can't do anything. You're absolutely locked up. Then we could talk about an untradeable contract.
Yeah.
But let's hope it's not. Maybe it was also labeled just an ACL injury, because maybe it wasn't a tear. Maybe it was just precautionary. I mean, we don't know anything. So that intel really drives the conversation in some capacity, because right now we're just guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he said going into the season that as long as he stayed healthy, the smart play was for him to opt out and sign a new contract. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I guess from Kawhi's perspective, like, you see KD opt out after the Achilles injury and you still get a 4-year max deal. So, like, even if the Clippers aren't willing to take that gamble, someone else will be. I have no doubt that if Kawhi opts out, he will get a max deal from someone. But
yeah, that's fair.
But I'm with you. I'm nervous. We don't know the full extent of whatever is going on with Kawhi's knee. I think that much has been very clear over the last, how long has this been? Since 2018 at this point? Like, he is being very smart about hiding the full scope of it from the public, because it's going to affect his future earnings beyond anything else. But, like, it seems like it's going to be a chronic problem. So if you're the Clippers, yes, you just have to ask yourself, it's similar to the Sixers and Joel Embiid. It's like, are we ever going to get a fully healthy Kawhi Leonard throughout an entire playoff run? I don't think either team knows the answer to that question.
No, it seems unlikely. And I hate to say that, but it seems unlikely. I mean, there's just something flares up all the time with him, and it makes sense. Like, some people are just different in terms of what their body can handle. I think for whatever team he's played on to be shown some caution in regards to the back-to-backs and whatnot, that's been great for him. I mean, there's a reason he's played the best 3-year stretch of his career over the past 3 years. It's because he's been pacing himself, and the training staff and the coaching staffs have been behind that decision. So I think that is the move forward. And honestly, if I sign him, I don't care whether or not he plays 82 games. That's not important to me. Like, he's probably going to, in the plays that he's playing, in the games that he's playing, you know, whether that's 60, 65 games, 70, you're probably going to win 60% of those games anyway.
Right.
Like, you're going to make the playoffs. I'm not concerned about that. Like you said, it is, do I have him available for the NBA Finals if I go that far? If not, I'm sorry to be so cynical, but what's the point then?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a incredibly crappy situation for the Clippers to have to deal with. But I think if he opts out, they're going to offer him the 5-year max, and you just have to pray at that point. But I'm with you thinking there will be speculation about his future over the next 4 weeks, because that's what we do with free agents. But given the way that he wanted to go to the Clippers 2 years ago, he handpicked Paul George as his teammate. You know, he saw what the Clippers did without him. I think it would be a very different story if the Clippers lost to the Mavericks in round one. But
yeah,
seeing them beat the Jazz without him, get the Suns to a game 6 without him in the Western Conference Finals, if I'm Kawhi Leonard, I'm not looking at this Clippers team thinking, oh man, there's no way I'm winning a championship here. I'm out of here. I'm going to go join Luka, where things are great in Dallas right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that ship has sailed.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think he stays. And I think the bigger question for the Clippers, assuming he does stay, we should just operate under that window, because if not, none of this matters. They'll probably have to totally retool their roster. Reggie right. Jackson was we have sung his praises repeatedly in recent episodes. One of the breakout stars of the playoffs. He timing worked out in his favor. He's a free agent now. I think it's fair to say he has earned a big raise over the minimum contract that he signed. So they have early bird rights on him as well, which means they can offer either 175% of his previous salary, which is not very much at all, or 105% of the average salary in the previous season. So for the numbers I've seen, that means his starting salary will be around $10.1 million.
Yeah, there we go.
Do you think that's enough to keep him?
Yeah. Not in terms of finances. So someone else is going to trump that offer. I don't think he cares.
Yeah.
He wants to be in L.A. Paul George is one of his best friends. He was rejuvenated with the Clippers. And a $10 million paycheck to stay in a place where you want to be, I think that's enough.
Yep. I'm right with you. I mean, who was it? Ramona Shelburne, I think, of ESPN, had a story about Reggie the other day talking about he was, like, ready to retire after his Pistons stint. And then, you know, he's, like, best friends with Paul George. Paul George convinces him to come play with the Clippers. And, like, it just, like, resuscitated his love for playing basketball. So I'm with you. I think there are going to be teams out there that are willing to offer him more money. And I don't think he cares.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I wrote an article on Forbes basically looking at the point guard market through the lens of the Chicago Bulls, who could use a point guard, and he came up. And it's just, even though the Bulls could clear enough cap space to actually pay him significantly more than what the Clippers could, it just doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't make sense virtually anywhere for him to go but the Clippers.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. He's best now as a spot-up shooter. He is best now feeding off of others. He's got two superstars to play alongside him on the wing to absorb all of this attention, leaving him with the ability to run around the three-point line, catching and shooting all day long. And he'll get paid $10 million to do so, and he'll get to be with his best buddies. Like, that's life. L.A., too, right, by the way. And we were talking about markets and whatnot, but also just weather, right?
Yeah.
Like that matters. I mean, again, it does. And I hate acknowledging that because 35 minutes ago, I was sitting there rooting for the small market teams, and I still do. But I'm not going to sit here and also say there isn't something intriguing about playing in warm weather cities.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, I think Reggie stays. And then Nick Batum, another guy who looked like he was just on his way out of the NBA, has a great year with the Clippers. What rights do they have on him? Nothing, just non-Bert. So they can't offer him much more than a minimum deal. But do you think that matters? Do you think Batum is getting a ton of money elsewhere? Do you think he's coming back as well?
I don't think he's getting offered a ton of money elsewhere. I think someone will definitely offer more than that. Mm-hmm. But it really comes down to what he likes. I don't remember hearing anything about him having a similar relationship with the Clippers as Reggie Jackson, so I don't know how invested he is in sticking around. But I think he should be. I think it would make sense. I mean, again, when you have two superstars who also aligns age-wise with him, who can get you to the finals, presumably pending health, why wouldn't you want to grab that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's a good answer to that question. I was trying to look up. So I know he got stretched. The Hornets waived him. You know, he picked up his $27.1 million player option. They waived him and stretched his contract. So there's a dead cap hit of $9 million on their books for the next two seasons. I was trying to see if that money... did he get all $27 million already, or do you know if he...
No idea. If it was paid later, mm-hmm. No idea. Either way, he got his money.
Yeah, right. But I'm thinking, like, if he's getting paid $9 million from the Hornets for the next 2 years not to play for them, sign, you know, a min deal again with the Clippers, and you're still making $12 million. You're right. Either way, it doesn't matter. Like, that's the thing, I think, with both Jackson and Batum. You know, Batum signed a $120 million contract. Jackson had an $80 million contract. So these, like, these guys should be pretty set financially. It's not like, I think Campaign, you know, hasn't had a big contract yet. So, like, he, as much as he might want to stay with the Suns, if they can't offer him a huge contract in free agency, like, maybe he does look elsewhere. But for Batum and Jackson, like, they've made their money. Now they're probably in full, like, let's just screw it. Let's take whatever we can get and let's go win a ring.
Yeah. Honestly, I wonder if that's going to be a thing that teams are going to start monitoring now. Overpaid guys. Mm-hmm. Just sitting there waiting patiently until that contract runs out and that player has developed a super bad reputation because of the overpayment. Mm. And then they just swoop in. Like, we know there's a reason you got that contract. You might not have lived up to it, but you're sure as hell is going to live up to more than a mint deal. So that's, and that's what we got you on because your perception is crap. I wonder if that's just going to be the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still looking up this stretch thing. Yeah, it looks like he might get the Nick Batum might get $9 million paid out over the next 2 years. So both of them, Reggie and Nick, they're fine financially. They should. Yeah. Well, I mean, bottom line is, I think the Clippers, if Kawhi resigns, and then, you know, we'll see what happens with Serge Ibaka. He has a $9.7 million player option, but I would, at this rate, I would assume he probably picks that up, given the injury and, you know, he might feel like there's unfinished business. But I don't see any reason to think that this Clippers team can't be right back where they were next year. Like, I think they will still, if Kawhi's back and healthy, they should still be one of the Western Conference favorites going into next year.
I would agree.
All right. Well, that is a good place for us to wrap up. So enjoy the finals, everyone. Game one, again, is on Tuesday night. We will be back later in the week. We'll have some final stuff. We'll start talking draft as well. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort, and good luck on Wednesday.
Thank you. Have a good one, too, Brian. Take care, man.